contract amendment bill, B24B-2011. In our midst, we have our colleagues from Kingston. If there are any other provinces that are here, we will give them an opportunity to introduce themselves. Let me take this opportunity to welcome all members, and I hope that all members have got all the documentation that's supposed to be used in this meeting, the proposed agenda, the slides, and the draft and the bill, draft bill, amendment bill. I mean, all of us, the copy of that. You are all welcome members. Without any waste of time, let me take this opportunity to hand over to the department to lead us on the presentation of the National Health Amendment Bill. I said I'm going to allow an opportunity for all members to introduce themselves. Let me start with that first. I will start on my left, members.
I'm representing Gauteng as NCOP. Member Mule.
Thank you. Noma Kiki Majola from KZN Legislature. I'm Boshi Saga from KZN Legislature.
Rani Pondombela, KZN Legislature.
Good morning. My name is Willem Fava. I represent the NCOP from the Northern Cape.
Good morning, my name is Michael De Villiers. I'm representing the Western Cape.
Morning, members and department. My name is Sipho Plaki. I'm from the Northwest Province. I'm in the NCOP, sitting in the same select committee.
Okay. Chairperson John and Nikulu.
Good morning. I'm Kululi Molo. I'm a researcher for this committee.
Parliamentary monitor. PMG, yes. But I'm looking for our state advisor.
Parliamentary.
Parliamentary. What? Legal advisor. Parliamentary.
State law advisor.
Yo. Okay, where's our legal advisor from the parliament? They're not here. How come? They were informed. Yeah, because they have to be here to assist us. You know, it's an important deal here. Okay, on that note, can I hand over to... Oh, we have our whip, the committee whip here. Can we introduce ourselves?
My name is Martha Lavoroto from Mpumalanga, representing Mpumalanga in the NCOP. Thank you.
There are other members who are sitting behind us over there. Can you please introduce yourself? Hey, what? Okay, without any more waste of time, here walks Honorable Member Makunyane from Limpopo. Yes. Let me hand over DG to take us through the bill.
Thank you, Honorable Members. Thank you, Chair. I would like to start on page 13, just to give an overview on the outline, and then I'll go back, if you allow me. I'm sorry to do this to you. I thought it would help with the outline. Just to say what this bill is about. It's called the National Health Act, which was passed in 2003. Mm-hmm. So this bill seeks to amend the National Health Act. The purpose of the National Health Amendment Bill is mainly to empower the minister to establish an independent entity, namely the Office of Health Standards Compliance. Honorable members, we need this office mainly because the standards of our health services.
Okay. There's a register circulating for the purposes of knowing exactly who's here. Can you please find it, members? Over to you.
Thank you very much. The standard. Should I bring it to this better? Okay. Thank you very much. I beg your pardon. The Office of Health Standard Compliance is aimed at ensuring that our health establishments, which are defined in terms of the National Health Act, comply with said standards. So the proposal here is that there should be amendments of about 8 clauses. We seek to amend Section 1 of the Act, Section 21, Section 25, Section 47, but also we are proposing that there should be substitution of Section 10, Section 90, and there are other consequent amendments that will be effected as a result of these changes. In terms of Section 1 of the Act, we are proposing insertion of definitions. The one particular definition that we are inserting is that of the environmental health practitioner. Environmental health practitioner is like what we used to call health inspectors in the past. But in terms of the Health Professions Council, we are described as environmental health practitioners. So we wanted to align our National Health Act with what is provided for in other pieces of legislation. The second is amendment of Section 36 of the Act, which is, if we look at Clause 2, it seeks to amend Paragraph F of Section 21 of the Act in order to assign port health services to the National Sphere of Government. And honorable members, if you allow me, I want to explain. You might have recalled that we had an incident with a number of about 25 Nigerians who were deported back to Nigeria because they did not have yellow fever certificate. It is required in terms of international health regulations that our ports of entry must regulate the entry of citizens of other countries that come from countries that have high risk status in terms of yellow fever. So this is just that one aspect that we want to address, but there are a whole lot of other aspects of international health regulations that South Africa has to comply with. Because we are a signatory and a member state, we have introduced some of these steps on compliance with these international health regulations. The most important of these regulations is to ensure that there is control of transmission of diseases and that these can be controlled at our port of entry. But secondly, it is also about ensuring that all our ports of entry, land, air, as well as inland, this is how they describe it, inland and sea, as well as air, are manned by competent port health officers. Now, the incident that we've just had is indicative of the weaknesses in the system, in that you cannot implement international health regulations by having provincial differentials and differences in the manner in which these regulations are implemented. So there must be standardization across board. So it is for that reason that there is this proposal to effect these amendments, and it's consistent with what the World Health Organization provides for. The third clause is that of amending Section 25 of the Act, and this is mainly to remove the word port health services under provincial sphere of government, which is pursuant to the amendment that is sought under Clause 2. Clause 4 is amendment of Section 47 of the Act, and this is mainly to amend the Principal Act so as to delete reference to the Office of Standards Compliance. When we presented to the Portfolio Committee for the first time, they said there are a lot of standard-setting bodies. Now, if you say Office of Standards Compliance, the public may not know what standards. So they specifically requested that it must be Office of Health Standard Compliance, so that it's clear that it's about health standards, not general standards. So reference to Office of Standards and Inspectorate of Health Establishments are replaced by the word Office of Health Standard Compliance. Chapter 10 is quite, it's a section that introduces substantive changes in that firstly, it makes provisions for the establishment of the office, the object of the office, its functions, control. When we introduced the bill for the first time to Parliament, we did not have provisions for the establishment of the board. As a result of public hearings and the Portfolio Committee concerns about the independence of the office. There were recommendations that there must be a provision for the establishment of the board. And it is for that reason the revised bill has a provision for the establishment of the board, a composition which outlines the composition, how board members should be appointed, as well as the chair and the vice chairs. It also indicates what types of committees should be appointed, committees of the board, as well as the appointment of the chief executive officer. It also assigns powers to the chief executive officer and lines of accountability. Because the provisions are such that the office is supposed to have the inspectorate, which is supposed to inspect every single health facility, it also makes provisions for how those inspectors should be appointed. It makes provisions for the establishment and appointment of the ombuds and outlines the functions of the ombuds. Because of the concerns that were raised about the independence, it also specifically specifies that there should be independence, impartiality and accountability of the ombuds. It specifies how inspections should be conducted. In particular, these inspections are supposed to assist with the enforcement of norms and standards that would have been established, developed with the concurrence between the department and the office itself. It also allows for environmental health investigations in terms of the functions of the inspectors. It makes provisions for inspectors to be able to enter, search, and seize if they have to, whatever is required by law in the premises or health establishment. It also makes provisions for constitutional rights to privacy and mechanisms by which those items that could have been seized by inspectors during inspections to be disposed in a particular manner. There are other miscellaneous provisions that relate to inspectors and compliance procedures, and it allows for appeals in the instance people are aggrieved. But there are also offenses and penalties in the event there are those who do not comply with the provisions of this amendment bill. So the establishment of the office, the proposed amendment provides for a juristic person in terms of the PFME, so that the office should be established in terms of Schedule 3A public entity. It also allows for the office to be funded by parliamentary appropriations and fees for services where appropriate. The recommendation is that the board that is established in terms of this amendment bill must be a technical board. The recommendation of a technical board is because the establishment of standards, norms and standards of health establishment is a technical process for which a recommendation here is that the board must be a technical board. It makes provision for the board to appoint the CEO and advises the minister on the appointment of the ombuds. With regard to the objects of the Office of Health Standard Compliance is there to protect and promote health and safety of users of health services. Members may be aware of some of the current challenges with regard to safety problems in some of our facilities and reports of lowered standards. It allows for monitoring and enforcing of compliance so that our health establishment can at least comply with prescribed norms and standards. If I were to cite an example, honorable members, our academic complexes are training institutions, and they have to produce our medical doctors, our nurses, and others. And for them to do that, they have to comply with certain standards so that our health professionals can be recognized internationally. Now, if there are no norms and standards that our health establishment comply with, it undermines even the training of our health professionals. This will also ensure that the investigations are conducted, but there are also ways by which members of the public can complain. And in the complaints that have been submitted, there are actions taken after these complaints. It also helps in the instances where there are breaches and non-compliance with norms and standards for action to be taken. So the office is supposed to advise the minister on the determination of norms and standards, and these have to be prescribed in regulations, but it must also inspect the health establishments, and for those health establishments that comply, they must be certified that they comply with norms and standards. But we must be able to also, on the basis of this, be assured by the office that for those that comply with the prescribed norms and standards, the certification is made public. The public knows that this is a certified health establishment because it complies with standards. But for those health establishments that do not comply, then such a certificate should be withdrawn if it has been issued before. And this is information that should be publicly made available. But it also provides for investigation of complaints, monitoring of indicators of risk, establishment of early warning systems, as well as identification of specific areas, whether in provincial, national, or municipalities where we have health establishments, notification of any problems of non-compliance. It allows for publication of information of these norms and standards through different media, electronic, print, and so on. It also recommends that there should be a quality assurance and management system for the whole national health system that should be approved by the Minister of Health. It allows for keeping of records, and the minister has to be advised accordingly. The office is expected to issue guidelines on an ongoing basis so that the health establishments and the health professionals and the health workers working in those health establishments know exactly what the expectations are. The office is expected to collect information about these health establishments, about the users, so that on an ongoing basis, user satisfaction surveys are conducted, or some patient fora are established so that we can know whether the users are happy with the service that they are getting. It is expected to liaise with other regulatory authorities, particularly on matters that are considered to be of common interest. And in this regard, your professional statutory bodies like the Nursing Council, the Health Professions Council, and other professional statutory bodies, because they've got a duty and responsibility of regulating professionals. It has to liaise with these institutions. In the event that there are breaches, there should be communication between these regulatory agencies. But it is also because there are certain standard-setting bodies that also perform other related functions. And in this regard, there must be exchange of information and some mutual agreement between the statutory bodies and the Office of Health Standard Compliance. This was raised sharply during the public hearings, that we should avoid duplication of effort. And where possible, if there are already certain functions that are performed by other statutory bodies, the Office of Health Standard Compliance should not go and duplicate the same functions. In this regard, the proposal here is that there must be negotiated agreements with different statutory bodies on how specific areas can be regulated. So the minister may prescribe different norms and standards for different types of health establishments. For instance, it is not expected that a clinic will have the same norms and standards as a hospital, for instance. So a hospital will have specific norms and standards, a clinic will have specific norms and standards, your community health center will have specific norms and standards. So for each level, there will be specific norms and standards where each health establishment will be expected to comply. So it makes provisions for the appointment of the board and CEO. And in this regard, the office will be under the control of the board. The board must determine policy of the office, plans, functions, powers, but also other functions that may be assigned to it in terms of this act. The proposal is that in terms of the composition of the board, it must consist of no less than 7 and no more than 12 members who will be appointed by the minister. So appointment of members, it will have the chairperson and vice chairperson. It will also have a different categories of other members with certain technical skills, but it also provides for the disqualification of these members and the vacation of office. It determines how often the board must meet and the compilation of minutes and recording of decisions, because the decisions of the board will be far-reaching, in that if a facility does not comply at all, the board will have to take into account whether in deciding whether it will limit access, for instance, to services. So those kind of considerations will have to be made on an ongoing basis by the board. It also allows for the establishment of committees, technical committees, both internal and external. With regard to the appointment of the CEO will be appointed by the minister after consultation with the board for a 5-year term, which is renewable only once. The CEO will be subject to a performance agreement, but there are also provisions for removal from office of the CEO and arrangements for acting CEO in the event that the CEO is removed from office, and other benefits that goes with the package of the CEO. But it also makes provision for the CEO to be styled as accounting officer in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, and outlines the functions in terms of the Public Service Act and other related Labor Relations Act and other laws that apply. There are certain powers and assignment of duties that can be delegated, and lines of accountability and reporting that are expected of the CEO, as provided for by our parliamentary process, for instance, submission of annual reports and so on. The office is supposed to have inspectors. Like I said earlier, that inspectors have to go and inspect facilities to establish whether they comply with set standards. It also makes provision for appointment of health officers and certificates of appointments and obligations, so that when they enter a facility, they can produce a certificate to say we are inspectors, and the public can know who is an inspector and who is not. They must also be given powers of peace officers in law. With regard to the appointment of the ombud, this appointment will be by the minister after consultation with the board. The recommendation is that it must be a 7-year term, non-renewable, with specific terms and benefits. It must be located within the office. However, the ombud must be independent, so that if the CEO does not implement certain things, the public must be able to raise concerns with the ombud. So the functions, the public must and should and must be enabled to report their, to raise their complaints with the ombud with regard to the norms and standards that have been set. The ombud must investigate and also consider matters of non-compliance with norms and standards in a fair, economical, and expeditious manner. And for all the complaints that may involve acts of omission by a person in charge of a particular establishment, let's say a CEO of a hospital, those kind of instances the ombud must investigate. They may also use inspectors so that they can get information. They may subpoena people and ensure that processes are administratively fair. They may refer complaints where necessary to other suitable bodies, which, for instance, if matters require police intervention or other statutory bodies, like I said earlier, your nursing council or the health professions council, they may refer other matters to those statutory bodies. It must provide reports and recommendations to the CEO, but also state what action needs to be taken, and also find a way of a dispute resolution through the minister. It must also inform those who have complained, the complainants, of the outcome of their findings, of the findings after he has investigated or she has investigated as an ombud, and what recommendations the ombud has come up with. That information must be shared with the complainants. The concerns that have been raised were mainly with the independence, impartiality, and accountability of the ombud. There must be earmarked funding specifically provided by Parliament. Some recommendations were made that the ombud should report directly to Parliament about these complaints, and some views were that administratively it's not clear how that will happen because we already have the Chapter 9 institution, and the ombud in terms of this act is not necessarily a Chapter 9 institution, so it was not clear how this would unfold. But the proposal was that when dealing with any complaints in terms of the act, the ombud must be independent and impartial, and they must perform their functions in good faith without fear, favor, bias, or prejudice, and annual reports must be provided to the minister and must be tabled in Parliament like other processes that are provided for in terms of the Public Finance Management Act. With regard to inspections, the health officer or inspector may enter, like I said, search and seize, take samples, photographs. They must also issue a compliance notice if the problems persist, and the compliance certificate will only be issued when there's evidence that a health establishment complies with the set standards. but the compliance certificate will be valid for no more than 4 years unless revoked, and it can be renewed in a prescribed manner. For non-compliance, the inspector may issue notice of non-compliance to a person in charge of the health establishment, the CEO of a hospital, for instance, or a clinic manager. And the notice must specify the health establishment consent, and it must say what are those norms and standards that have not been complied with, and it must say what the nature and extent of non-compliance is, and what steps are required to be taken by that health establishment, and over what period, and what penalties may be imposed, and other sanctions that are necessary. And the notice remains in place until the problems that have been identified by the office have been addressed, and the office may then issue a certificate of compliance or until there's been an appeal. So if a person in charge of a health establishment, like your CEO or clinic manager, fails to comply with the notice, the proposal here is that the office may take appropriate action and also take into account the nature, the extent, the gravity and severity of the contravention. For instance, in the event you've got deaths of babies in a hospital because infection control procedures were not followed, that is considered to be serious. In those instances, we must say exactly what kind of action must be taken. So firstly, these are the processes that are recommended. A written warning must be issued and in a prescribed manner, and also must say that it also must stipulate the requirements of how and when the responsible person in that health establishment must respond. And if there's a relevant authority that needs to take action, for instance, if a person has to be struck off the roll by the Health Professions Council, that kind of action will be recommended. If disciplinary proceedings must be instituted, that will also be recommended. But it will also recommend to the minister for temporary or permanent closure. But this will be a carefully considered decision, because you also cannot deny people access. For instance, if you have a hospital and it's just one ward in a hospital that is non-compliant, you can therefore not say the whole hospital should be closed. It might as well be that it is only the ward that is temporarily closed until the problems are resolved, especially, for instance, in the instance there's non-compliance with the infection control, or there's a Klebsiella outbreak and people have not followed a particular procedures and processes. In respect of non-compliance, there may be a penalty imposed, but this one was debated to say who is going to pay the fine, because it's within the same health establishment. It will be eating resources from the health establishment, so this was debated. So the matter may be referred to the National Prosecuting Authority, particularly if it's a criminal offence. So the Chief Executive Officer will inform the Director General of any persistent non-compliance of some of the health facilities. The environmental health investigation, the health officer obligation is to investigate any violations with regard to pollution and other nuisances, determine who is responsible, and also issue compliance notice and what corrective action must be taken. It also must say who are the persons that are affected, but those may have a right of appeal. Entry and search of premises or health establishment. So this is for health inspectors to be able to enter, search and seize, but it also stipulates that this should be done consistent with the Constitution. So so that the privacy of individuals is not undermined. The identification of prior to and resistance against entry. In the event that people deny inspectors entry, there must be procedures followed to get a warrant and share this and inform those whose establishment need to be inspected. And this warrant, of course, will be produced, and they will demand entry, communicate reasons, and affix or hand over the warrant as appropriate. And where possible, if this persists, then other measures will be considered. So entry and search of premises or health establishment without a warrant, the inspector may exercise the above powers if agreed, or may look at other options, but this must be done within the provisions of the Constitution, and this has been informed by other cases, like the Mystery case in terms of the Medicines Act, where people entered people's houses, searched and seized, and this was considered to be unconstitutional. Disposal of items seized by the health officer. The health officer inspector may dispose of items in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act. There are other provisions that may be relevant. For instance, the head of national or provincial departments or head of municipality or health establishment regarded as the owner or occupier of a relevant building. This law may also apply to those, and the employer of persons carrying out any duty or exercising any power in any of the health establishments that are provided for in the Act. So there are also provisions for the appeals against the decision of the office and the ombud. Any person who is aggrieved has provisions that allow for an appeal, which must be submitted to the minister within 30 days. And the minister may appoint an independent ad hoc tribunal of up to 3 persons with knowledge of law and the industry. And this may be a retired judge or magistrate, and they may vary or confirm or set aside the decision. But the affected parties will be informed accordingly. The amendment bill also makes provisions for offences and penalties. Any person who is guilty of an offence in terms of the Act, who obstructs or hinders inspections, refuses to provide information, impersonates an inspector, fails to comply with the compliance notice, discloses information, will be considered to be non-compliant, will also be subject to the provisions of Section 89. The offenders will be liable to a fine or imprisonment or both. So Clause 5 allows for amendment of Section 90 of the Act, and this allows the minister, in addition to the National Health Council, to make regulations. The minister, in making regulations in terms of the National Health Act, has to first consult the National Health Council. The National Health Council is all the MECs of health of 9 provinces and heads of departments. So he has to consult them whilst making regulations. It may be regulations about prescribed fees that must be paid to the office, about norms and standards that must be prescribed, the functions of the board, environmental health, removal of medical waste, and other nuisances. With regard to amendment of arrangements of the section of the Act, section clause 6.6 to amend the arrangements of the section to the Act as a result of the changes that have been made in chapter 10. There are also provisions that must be inserted to ensure that there's compliance with a PFMA that the office must comply with. Clause 8 is about the short title and commencement of the Act, the title of the bill, and the date which the bill will come into operation. Honorable members, this is the proposal The first part of the presentation deals with the discussions that went on in the portfolio committee. So I was not sure whether it was appropriate for us to present that to you. I thought I needed to just confine us to the bill. But in addition, we've also spent time doing preparatory work on two fronts. One, to prepare the provinces to get the health establishments to comply as soon as the act comes into force. We started, honorable members, with the audits. We've audited about 4,000 facilities, and we have a report about every single facility, every single health establishment. And our proposal is that in advance of this act coming into force, the provinces must start preparing to fix most of the problems that have been identified during the audit. But we've also started investigating some of the problems so that we can understand what they are, so that we can help provinces plan ahead in advance. Thank you.
Thanks very much, DG. On the issue of tabling what the portfolio committee has presented before you, I think we can do it later. Let's first allow discussion to take place in the committee and allow members to make their inputs. I can see that members are itching to make their issues here. First of all, DG, I know that this board is concerned with issues of quality assurance as one of the function of the board. Maybe if you can also tell us about the incidences of the medical waste disposal, which also affects the issues of an health environment. How does it feature into all this? And also the question on the the structure that was existing before that was dealing with quality assurance issues. I don't know whether I've missed in your presentation here. What was it called and what was this function? And also we've got environmental health practitioners at the district municipality level. What kind of authority does the structure of this board have on those people? And let me allow the members to ask questions. I'll start with you, Honorable, from Ubabe, and Honorable Nube, Honorable Mahlathi, John. Majola, yes. Honorable Majola, Honorable Faba, Honorable Civilias, Honorable Plagi. Did I miss a hand? Honorable Magunyan, yes. Mm-hmm. In that order. Okay?
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me just appreciate for having been invited to come here and the DDG having made the whole presentation for our sake, because when the presentation was done to the portfolio committees, we were not there. So I think it was really good for us to get this presentation. I don't know where to start, because I think portfolio committees, Chairperson, have got a constitutional right to exercise oversight. An oversight that, perhaps I'll be speaking for Gauteng, where we are in the process of actually even doing committee inquiry if we feel we need to have in-depth information from a particular program that seems to be having some lots of deviances and discrepancies. And even edging onto corruption, we want him to get to the depth of the problems that would be in that program. Why I'm saying this is the fact that there is this inspector who seems to be having so much power, powers that as if there's no committee that is going to be exercising oversight. Powers of the oversight here is being undermined in as far as this call. I can see this. Because everything that is going to be done seems like it's going to be done by a health inspector, and he should then, I don't know who he will be reporting to, whether the committee will then be overlooked and he will then be going to the ombudsman, and where does the ombudsman also report? Where does it fall in within the committee? Because it is the committee that also has to go into the house, do the recommendations that are turned into resolutions, and those resolutions must be tracked for the department to implement. And where does then, after he has found out all that he has found out, report to? It doesn't seem to be coming through here. Committees of completely are not even being mentioned on this bill. So I have my own reservations on this in terms of the powers that are given to health inspectors. And where does the ombudsman come in? Does he report to the committee? Does he have to come to the committee and do a presentation in as far as his work is concerned? Or is it just to do with the minister's office as a board? Where do we come in as a committee? Thank you, Chair.
I just want to clarify, you mean portfolio committees, select committees, and the committees at provincial level?
I'm talking about portfolio committees for health, yeah. And SGOP provincial, I think even at national.
Okay.
Where do we come in terms of this bill? How does the health inspector relate to us? Thanks.
No, thanks, Honorable Chairperson. Can you just refresh me, did you? Is it the board that is a juristic person?
And I'm not sure about the hospital whether it is also a juristic person. So give me clarity there. And maybe let me also indicate, you have posed the question also back to us in terms of the fine, the 10 million posed to a person. Which person? Which person? Because I might be working in the hospital, and if the non-compliance is for that unit, why should it be to a person instead of to be any juristic person, the hospital as an accounting locus? Maybe also want to welcome the introduction to or enforcement in terms of people coming from outside, and at the point of entry then they do this thing. Because if we're going outside, maybe there is a mad cow, they start spraying us in the flight, and when we land again, they spray us outside. But I've never seen it on ourselves. When was affecting us, I think 2010. Yes. We never ever sprayed anyone, and it was so detrimental. So what I'm asking is that as we introduce this, are we going to be able to enforce it as other countries are doing it with us? On the inspectors, you have talked about 49, I think you are saying, the preparatory work. On the inspectors, no. This bill, how much financial implication is going to pose to the province? Is there any additional money that is going to go to the province in terms of preparing for inspectors, appointing for inspectors? Because at the end, you may find Northern Cape not being able to have money, or KZN not having money, or Gauteng, because all other money goes to the personnel and infrastructure and whatever. So what are the financial implications then preparing for the treasury to give it all from the national ministry to give to provinces? There's nothing, I don't know whether it's the limitation of not having read the act. What happens if the board is dysfunctional? There's nothing that says the minister can disband, and then the introduction of the administrator. Because if it is silence in the Amendment Act, you can't disband it. And you can't also put in an administrator in terms of functioning. Fine, right to privacy. You talked about the right to privacy. I think it's twice. If the inspectors will come at any time in order to inspect whatever compliance, whose privacy? Because if you put that, if you say they can come at any time to check and may subpoena and all those things, wouldn't the institution say, no, it's our right to do ABCD and then we must respect our privacy? So this privacy thing may open up the loopholes if it is not clarified. Thank you.
Honorable Majola. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Gigi, for your presentation. I think it's coming at a very, very critical time because I will be revolving around, it's good to have this compliance as in place, here in place, but I'm looking at a situation that we, at our current situation now, we have got health facilities. When you are looking at them, in the line of compliance, there's no compliance at all. What is the reason for that? You are looking at that CEO who is being put there, a CEO with no staffing, a CEO with no equipment. You are having a maternity ward. In that maternity ward, you have got one professional nurse, one midwife, a midwife who is looking at we would say head on perineum at that particular time. Then if we are going to come up with this, and most of those health facilities are within town, go down to the rural areas where you are having old clinics that were there then. Now we want to upgrade them to this situation. How are we, the financial implications, that is number one. And how are we going to put in this compliance? You have said audit has been done. The audit that is being done is done by a compliance committee, a quality assurance committee, national. But we do have our quality assurance committees there who have already submitted reports of non-compliance with, because of the reason beyond the control, without staffing, without equipment, with everything. How are we going to have that compliance that we are looking at? Have we looked at those loopholes before we say, let us take this compliance bill? You said it is failure to comply. I've covered that one. Because at times we've got the failure to comply due to staff shortage, at times due to equipment, at times due to the very space. And on top of that, the very service providers, I would say, the providers that are appointed to build the new clinics, they build them and then commission them and hand over. When you are going there as the portfolio committee, you have got a waiting room that has got no windows, that has got everything, the critical things that are supposed to be there, they have never been there. And it is being taken as the clinic at the expense of the users of that facility. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would first like to ask on the who regulates, you know, when we are talking about regulating bodies, and I would like to know the traditional healers and traditional doctors, are they regulated at any stage by the department on this? Because I've seen nothing on that. So how are they being regulated? I mean, obviously it should fall under the Department of Health. Then on page 30, we are talking about the appointment of the ombuds. Now, it's a seven-year term, non-renewable, with specific terms and benefits. Why not 5 years? Why 7 years? Is there a specific reason for 7 years? And then I would also like to know, on page 33, when we talk about the compliance certificate valid for no more than 4 years, unless revoked. Now, when we are saying for no more than 4 years, is that actually for 4 years, and or can it be for a shorter term? What is the compliance? If I get a certificate, am I getting compliance for a year or for 4 years, or is it just, you understand what I'm saying, DJ, because it doesn't say for 4 years, it says for no more than 4 years. I would just like to get clarity on that as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. My first question is in connection with or in relation to Clause 78. And in Clause 78, it is mentioning about the norms and standards of the establishments and so on. Now, my question is, what will the department do to inform these establishments and also the organizations falling into this health system, so that they must know what they must do to be prepared when this bill is coming law. So we can't go that time to them and saying you not comply. So we must prepare them, you know. Just talk about on this issue to us as committee members. So when that situation happens, and I expect that we as members of parliament will be drawn into that dispute or something which might happen there. Then the other question, Honourable Chairperson, is in connection with Clause 79. The minister may prescribe different norms and standards. Now my question is here, it is inconsequent if there's different norms and standards and prescriptions to the establishment. So we must handle. I'm under the impression that we must compare apples to apples and not apples and pears and so on. It must be consequent. Then the other one is also the qualification for members belonging to the board. Or who? What will the qualifications be for any person to become a member of the board? Is there, or will they be drawn up by the department or the minister regulations so that they can qualify? That information. And then, Honourable Chairperson, there's another one on page 35 of the document. Of this document, that is 82A, clause 82A. Now, the issuing of a written warning. Then the other one is required from establishment a written response, recontinued non-compliance. Now, maybe I misread it, but there is no time frame for the response. So if the establishment received that letter, what time frame is there? They can take, say, 3 months, 6 months, a year. But there's some vague area in that connection. And then the other one which I'm very worried about is the in respect of that non-compliance imposed upon that person or health establishment. One or two of my colleagues already pose a question in this relation, but my other question here is when appointing a person as head of department or head of the establishment, then there's certain criteria written into his contract. Is it now or will it now expected from the board or those person who appoint that person in that situation? Will there be a revision on the contract? Because a person can be worried about old age homes, because there's also health circumstances there. Can the department just give us more information in relation to that? I think that is all, Honourable Chairperson. My question will end there. If there will be a second chance and I do have another question, I will make use of the opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair. I must say, I've been listening to DG when he explains the bill and the intention of the bill. It's correct. We need to regulate, put up standards to make sure that our facilities are compliant and are in good standard. But I just want to check with the DG that I guess this compliance, standard of compliance, applies both to private and public facilities. So I just guess, but DG can elaborate on that, whether the private sectors are also there. The other point that I wanted to check quickly, DG, you said the inspectors will have powers of a peace officers in laws. My understanding then went so wild and said that maybe you need that they would have a power that equals to even the police. If they want to arrest, they will arrest, and so on and so on. I wanted to check then what will then be the criteria of appointing these inspectors and what qualification these inspectors will have, the legal qualification or a health qualification, so that we must understand as they implement their functions, they do it within the prescript of law. And then the other point which my colleagues have just raised, it is on minister determining the norms and standards. Does he determine that in silos alone there, or does he consult extensively with stakeholders? And what then will be the roles of the statutory bodies that are in the health sector in terms of making sure that they actually input in the norms and standards that will be set out. And then the issues of them sizing information, I guess if they want a computer with an information and they want to take it, inspectors, you said as you presented, they have the right to size those information if they want it. Don't you think that this would lead to an unnecessary litigation? And then as and when litigation arises, is there any plans, maybe by the inspectors, do they have the potential resources to stand up and fight for any litigation against them? Or will that be the responsibility of the National Health Department?
Thank you, DG. Thank you, Kumuchi. Well, I think part of my question has been asked already. It was the first one was about whether the legislation as contemplated would cover also the private sector. And then the private sector, not just thinking about private hospitals and so on, but also those facilities where our poor people go, like doctors' consulting rooms and so on, at local level. The other one was about the norms and standards, whether this would cover strictly health issues or it would also cover the human element, about how staff within the health establishment treat people, how they treat people and so on. So whether this should also be covered in there. Because that interface of the the employees and the public that comes to those health facilities. It's a very sensitive issue, it's a major issue. The another one was where else does a similar mechanism operate, say in what country and how is it working and so on. And then the final one, it's about, I see similarly in the contemplated bill, I don't see much emphasis on public education, especially on, you know, educating people about what to expect, what kind of service to expect from hospital. Because if they don't know, then they think that anything that they get, they smart. So, that's my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Cheche. Mine is just one on ad hoc tribunal. Having reached that stage, it means that those people that are appointed by the minister to serve in that independent ad hoc tribunal should not only, in my opinion, have the knowledge of the healthcare industry, because having knowledge and being involved in there is something different. Maybe you need to clarify us as who are these people who have got that knowledge into this industry that you're talking about there. Because really, that will be the last, that will be the anybody who is operating here will have his heart on them to say they will assist you with whatever decision that comes out. I don't know what drives what is the rationale behind the renewal once. Maybe if we can get that for the CEOs, that you can only renew once. I'm looking at a situation where the CEO is excelling and doing his job and everybody is satisfied after having served a second term and he's just removed for no apparent reason. Maybe there is the rationale behind that. Thank you, Chair. That's enough.
Yeah, just last question from my side. On page 12, you refer to some groups asking for exclusion, for instance, the pathology. Can you elaborate on that? And also, how often will the inspection of health facilities be done? How often within that period? And what kind of assistance will the National Department provide to those facilities that are non-compliant? Because we cannot just pounce on them and say, no, we are not complying, therefore we send you to that tribunal or whatever. The interventions that have to be put in place. Yeah, those will be the additional questions. Over to you, Diju. Oh, well, let me check. Is the parliamentary legal person here from the legal services, from parliament?
No.
Eh?
Okay.
Yeah, from something. He is not here. Over to me.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and Member. I will prepare the response in the order that they were asked. Firstly, from the Chair of the Portfolio Committee in Gauteng. Or maybe let me start with the Chair's question. The first question, Chair, you raised was about medical waste. And I just want to share the experiences, and maybe for the Honourable Member's information. The audits that were conducted were actually our own audits to prepare ourselves. We assigned Health Systems Trust together with other partners to go and audit all our facilities. Chair, if you may recall, the Minister has come to the NCOP and Portfolio Committee explaining the six core standards. I will not refer to the rest of the standards. I just want to talk about the six. Now, these six are about cleanliness, safety, and security of our health workers and patients. It's about infection control, the long queues in our facilities. It's about medicine stock out in our facilities and the attitude of health workers. Meaning, in addition to human resources, equipment, whether it's functional or not, about clinical excellence, about bulk waste and other things. At least we said those six must be in place. When we audited all the facilities, I just want to give this background so that you can know what we are dealing with. When we audited all the six facilities, the 4,000 facilities, honorable members, some of the findings were really disturbing. They were really disturbing because in our country, 80% of our facilities did not comply. Meaning 80% of our facilities are not clean. If you know, our health establishments should be the cleanest place that our people go to. It cannot be that we write a law in this country today to get our facilities to be clean. It cannot be. By virtue of a health establishment, it must be clean. So we're trying to build a system whereby we say, let's build and create that culture of cleanliness in our health facilities. Honorable members, you will recall that we had reports dating back from 2009 of deaths of babies in our facilities. Neonatal ICU, we also have reports of babies who were not put in cots, proper cots, but in boxes.
Yeah.
Now, you cannot say today that a law that forces it, in fact, what you are saying with this law, you are actually saying a province must direct resources where they matter most. They must buy cots for babies and not put babies in boxes. It's a measure of getting the provinces as well as the hospitals, clinics, every health worker to comply. It's a responsibility of all of us, and I think this is how we should look at it. When we conducted the audits of the 4,000 facilities, and I want to start with this one of medical waste. Honorable member, we can show you data. We can actually show you pictures as well. I've got pictures where I can show you in one facility, at least one that I can refer to. They did not have medical waste collected. They actually dug a hole to dump facility. You cannot have that in a health facility. In a province which I will not name, Honorable Chair, because I'll talk to individual members because... Pardon? Pardon? Okay. In this province, let me just share with you. What has happened because of lack of collection of medical waste? What has happened? Because it has been tidying up. There are rats, and now we're seeing our colleagues saw snakes. We can show you a picture of a snake in a facility. So in one facility, in fact, in a district, we went to some of the facilities. They, chair, did not have supply of water. And we asked, but why is water not supplied to the facility? For 3 years, there was no supply of water. The nurses go with buckets. The nurses go with buckets to a tank to collect water for a facility. In one facility, the nurses and the health workers did not have cleaning materials, so they collect money themselves to buy mops and cleaning agents and so on. So we have those reports, we have pictures, we have everything. In some, the drain was blocked for months and months, Chair. And we asked, but why is this drain not fixed? The health worker said they wrote a letter. They wrote a letter to a district. Now the question is, how do you get everybody to account? It's not enough to write a letter to a district. If the district does not respond, what is it that is expected? So what we did, Chair, we went, we set up teams. After the audit, we said we want to prepare our facilities to respond because we don't want the office, once it's in force, to pounce, as you said. Now we set up what we call facility improvement teams. These are teams between national, province, and districts. And Chair, for the number of facilities that we've seen improvements, we have the before and after stories to share with you. We did not prepare that presentation, not for this meeting, because we thought we'd discuss the bill. But if you invite us, we will show you the before and after. Chair, we recognize that there are structures that exist. We also recognize the role of the committees. We respect the institutions of government, whether it be parliamentary oversight bodies or section chapter 9 institutions. But hear what we are saying, Chair. In this lesson, we actually have a benchmark exercise that we've done of all countries that have gone this route. We can share that report with you. You'll see that it is not unique for South Africa to do this. It is actually desirable. It will not and should not replace the oversight role of parliamentary structures. If anything, it should strengthen your role, because you should be able to be given a report and make people to account. But you need foot soldiers to go and get this. You will not be able, honorable members, to inspect 4,000 facilities. You will not be able to tell whether an equipment works or not and for how long has it been broken. But the inspectors must be able to get that information for you, to give it to you. But you can then ask the questions, why has money not been allocated to fix these things? Chair, we recognize that the powers of inspectors, maybe they've gone overboard. But what we were trying to say is that you also don't want people not to account. Let us give you examples. We have committed health workers. Like I said, nurses who do not have cleaning material, but who use their own resources to buy brooms and mops and soap. We are saying, but it should not be. It cannot be. Because Parliament appropriates money for that purpose. And it is for that reason that the office must say, what is it that the CEO did? But we've also found out very interesting observations. Chair, let me use an example. For some CEOs, they did not have delegated power. If at Lowe's, for instance, in the parking lot, how do you say it? Birth. Okay? And the whole parking lot is dark. The CEO cannot buy a loop. And we say, but how can it be? They have to write and ask for permission for a loop to be bought elsewhere. So what we did with the audit, they reveal very interesting observations. Let me use an example. We say, if you look at security services, because one of the standards that we determined, because remember, honorable members, when you read the papers, they say we have our nurses that have been raped. We had a doctor that was stabbed in Mpumalanga. I can make a list in Chris Hani Barra. We saw recent events. We say because of that, we have to establish and assess whether the security services that we have are adequate. Chair, the findings were that with the security, we have outsourced and insourced services. For the insourced services, because of shortage of staff, your security officer or security guard also serves as a porter. In some instances, we also discovered that for those services that are outsourced, honorable members, the contracts are managed elsewhere, meaning a tender was issued by the Department of Security and Safety and Security, but the hospital CEO does not even know what the terms are. The contract terms are such that at the hospital there must be 10 security guards, but there are only 2. But the CEO does not even know that. Because this outsourced service that information does not exist in the facility. So we want every single aspect to be adequately addressed. Chair, I can go on and on. All what I was saying is that this bill is supposed to correct those problems. And it is supposed to also strengthen the oversight role of the committee. I think, Chair, it's up to the committee to decide whether you'd like the ombudsperson to come here to present and the CEO, like you normally get us to account and to report. I think it's within the right of the committee to determine that. As to how you want it reflected in law, I think it's some consideration. Chair, honorable member from Gauteng said that it is unclear whether it is the board that is jurisdiction. We say it's the office. It should be able to sue and be sued. I've raised the concerns about the 10 million rand fine because it's a difficult problem. The question is, how do you introduce punitive measures? Because one is that you also don't want to take resources away from facilities, because that 10 million rand must also buy medicine, must also help pay for services. So the question is, what punitive measures do we need that will serve as a deterrent so that our health workforce can appreciate why it's important that the users of our services should be protected? They should not go to our facilities to be harmed. In fact, they should go to our facilities to be looked after, to be cared for, and to be made well again. Chair, the Port Health Officers, honorable members, yes, I must say that we would like them to enforce the international health regulations as provided for, as well as the example that honorable member raised on H1N1. South Africa has an obligation to comply with international health regulations, including what the honorable member referred to earlier. And it is for that reason that we need to train all our port health officers. In fact, all the provinces that have inland, air, sea port health services, we've written them already to say they would like to have a training program. Honorable member, yes, indeed, there are financial implications. I'm going to ask Dr. Marshall to establish how far we are. We actually had a presentation about preparatory work that has already started. What we would like to propose, honorable members, is that this piece of legislation must be incremental. It will obviously not be possible for provinces to comply immediately. We have equipment that does not work, and our view is that we must have processes in place. We suggest that, Chair, when we address the portfolio committee, for instance, that if you look at our model of procurement and maintenance as well as servicing of equipment, it's such that we buy equipment, when it breaks, we replace with a new one, when we could actually fix. We are proposing that we should have clinical engineers that are employed in our facilities who are available to fix equipment as it breaks, so that it doesn't have to be replaced at huge cost. Equally, infrastructure, honorable members, we are suggesting there must be resident engineers who are available to fix things as they break. We don't wait for them and we get used to them that, you know, they're broken. When we did the audit in one of the provinces, we discussed this with the health workers. We said, but you've had a blocked drain. Why is it not fixed? They could not say. But they then went to fix the drain. They went to fix, meaning they've gone to fix. And their response was that they had become used to the abnormal such that it became normal. So what we're saying is that we need to change the culture, honorable members, so that health workers, when something is wrong, they fix it, so that we rebuild our health system from that perspective. Honorable members, I think this is a serious omission about when the board is dysfunctional. Indeed, there must be a provision for replacement of members and so on. I think it's a it's an omission that I think you can rectify. The rest to privacy. We made this provision only because, and I take what the member said, it may be used as an excuse to prevent inspectors from inspecting. And I'll ask the lawyers to say whether can it be abused in that way. There is that possibility. And I think we should thank the member for raising that because it must be looked at again carefully. Honorable member from KZN, the audit findings are quite revealing because there are facilities that are doing well. We were quite impressed because in some provinces we got the attitude. Health workers in some facilities had very good attitude. There were facilities that were clean. And there were facilities with functional equipment. And when we assessed, we also tried to understand why certain facilities perform that well. It's clear that it also comes back to management, honorable members. If you recall, adverts were sent out for CEOs who did not comply. And for that reason, we're hoping that with the appointed CEO who are trained, some of the problems that you've referred to can be addressed. But we recognize the shortages, hence we are recommending that this must be incremental. Honorable members from Northern Cape about traditional healers, there is actually an act that establishes the Traditional Practitioners Council that is supposed to have oversight over traditional healers. So that council must be appointed so that they can start making traditional healers to comply in terms of the Traditional Healers Practitioners Act, because it is now law. Honorable members, the 7-year term, our proposal initially was 5 years, and the portfolio committee changed it to 7 years. So we... Yes, at the time they had raised the concern that sometimes when people, and I think it's also linked to the other question about the CEO, that just as they are about to perform their work, then they are replaced. And then you start all over again. I think it was about that purpose. There was also a debate about whether you renew the term of the ombudsman person or you just appoint them for 7 years and you stop. I think it was a debate within the portfolio committee. And
we must keep the politicians and also. They'll be happy.
We are five.
So it was a matter that was debated. The compliance certificate, perhaps maybe the provision must be clearer to say that it is for 4 years. So that there's no ambiguity. The idea here is that in the event it has to be revoked, then it will not be for the full 4 year term. So until a facility complies or a health establishment complies with the requirements, it was for that purpose. But I think the lawyers can explain. I will give them an opportunity. Chair, I'm going to ask Dr. Marshall to refer to the norms and standards and what is it that is anticipated with regard to ensuring that the public is informed. We've actually had roadshows with the public to start informing them about the health roadshows, even for health workers, so that they can know. But Dr. Marshall will say exactly what is it that is done, including the preparatory work that is already done, which was part of the latter part of the presentation. In terms of the section 82A about the written warning and the time within which a response must be submitted by a health establishment. Honorable member, I just want to share an experience in the inspection work that is done for good manufacturing practice for manufacturing site. Normally you give the timelines relative to the nature of the offense or the lack of compliance. In one instance, it can be 1 month, and also based on risk. You don't want to perpetuate the risk in a facility. In some instances, you want them to respond within a shorter period because you want to minimize the harm that the patients may be exposed to. So to write that in law, it will be difficult because then you say 1 year, what if it should be 1 month? So we would rather write that in regulations, but also have the flexibility to specify depending on the nature of the problem that needs to be addressed by a health establishment. The old age home, Dr. Marshall will tell you, we've been debating about how do we get the ambulances, for instance, to comply. Do we define them as a health establishment, old age home? So it's a long list. We'll have to publish a list of the health establishment that must comply with this law, including the old age home, if nursing and health care services are rendered in those facilities. Indeed, honorable member from Free State and Limpopo, the act will apply to both the public and the private, because the public uses all these facilities and all these facilities must comply. The powers of peace officers, honorable members, the bias that we have as health workers would obviously start with the first technical skill that is required so that you are able to investigate the equipment as to whether it works and other health related activities, because we'd also like to ensure that there is clinical compliance with the guidelines. Meaning, if you say that this is how a patient should have been treated, because remember, this law is supposed to introduce preventative measures to avoid harm. We should not act after the fact, meaning as health establishments introduce these measures, they must do it in such a way that they prevent any possible harm. As to whether the legal skills are required, I think it's an area where training can be provided, but I think our lawyer can advise on that one. I don't know whether it's allowed. They wanted to know if karate, I don't know. Sure. So, in honorable member from Free State, the consultation on norms and standards, we are hoping that, or Northwest, my apologies, Free State, oh yes, my apologies, Northwest, consultation with regard to norms and standards. Honorable members, would also like to come and present the norms and standards so that you can also know what the expectations are. We'd like to share that with the public, but also with those who must comply with the norms and standards. And information dissemination. Honorable members, we actually have information about the extent of litigation. It has skyrocketed. Skyrocketed because the lawyers now see health as a potential area where they can act. And I just want to cite the former Secretary for Health of the UK when they had the death of babies in Bristol Infirmary. When the babies died, there was quite a lot of hype in the UK, and as part of the investigation, they actually came up with an approach where they said they want to move away from a blame culture where health workers can also see this as their responsibility to comply with quality. But he also made a very profound statement that he would like to remove lawyers from hospitals and doctors from courts. So if we implement this law, we'll have less of our doctors spending hours and hours in court, and less of our lawyers going to our facilities to get cases so that they can sue. And it is in that spirit that I think we have to look at litigation from that perspective. Honorable member, the experience about where this exists. I just shared the experience of the UK when they had the death of babies in Bristol Infirmary. re-establish what is called the Care Quality Commission, which is an equivalent of the Office of Health Standard Compliance. But they also introduced a patient forum, meaning forums where patients can share their experiences, but also a complaint system that can also help the health system to respond. Equally, they establish what is called the National Health Service Education Authority, because they were also seeing high cases of litigation. Honorable members, if you allow us, we'll ask our parliamentary officer to share with you the benchmark exercise that we did, which is a comparative study that we did of all the countries that have implemented this kind of legislation that has established similar bodies. Chair, with regard to the tribunal, I'll defer this to the lawyer to respond to that. The renewal of CEO, it's probably true, honorable members, that sometimes we it's something that the minister has recently shared to say, just as our professors and health workers are at their peak, then we let them go. We might want to perhaps look at exemptions maybe, but we also want to ensure that we don't create a fiefdoms. Honorable Chair, you raised this question about exclusion of pathology. The pathology laboratories were actually saying, if you look at the lab, there's no interaction there with the patient. What we are doing with this law is to protect a person first who uses our facility. We will regulate those services as they apply in our facilities, the manner in which blood is taken and how the results are shared with the patient and so on. But as to what happens to the lab, there are other standards that apply, SANS. So they were saying that maybe we should rely on those standards, and it is why we said we can then have the MOUs between the office and other statutory bodies. So how often will this be done? I will ask Dr. Marshall to respond to that. And how will the facilities be assisted? Honorable members, we've set up the facility improvement team. If you allow us, we can come back again and share, but also encourage the provincial committees that the provinces also share these improvements that have been introduced, so that they can, on an ongoing basis, assess the level of readiness of the provinces. Chair, I would also like to say that we've started what we call mock inspections. Mock inspection is just to try and see whether the tools that we've developed, the approaches that we would like to follow, are appropriate. And so far, Dr. Marshall will tell you that they've inspected 85 facilities. And we're beginning to see the changes and the attitude, because it's also important for this to evolve. Health workers must get used to this process of being inspected. I'd like to hand over to Dr. Marshall to answer some of the questions and the lawyer. Thank you, Chief.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Madam Chair and honorable members. I had, I think, three things the DG asked me to talk about. The first was about costs. I think we need to recognize that there are different types of costs associated with a process like this. The first, I think, was in relation to the office itself. There is a budget that has already been made available under the medium-term expenditure framework to appoint the teams of inspectors. And over time, the functions of the office will have to be expanded to be able to carry out some of the other functions that are in the bill. In the MTEF for this year, we've got 48.5 million rand, and we are in the process of talking to Treasury about the costs for next year. Obviously, an inspectorate is a costly intervention in terms of a single institution, but when you look at it compared to the total health budget, it's really minuscule. It's very, very small. The second type of costs, which I think the Honourable Member was referring to, was the costs at facility level to actually be able to meet the standards. Mm. And obviously, I think the DG has referred quite extensively to those, and I think they're not small, and it's one of the reasons why it has to be progressive. However, the work that we have been doing on these mock audits and in preparing the tools in the first place shows us that, in fact, many of the standards health workers accept that they do not require additional resources. That in many, many cases, health workers' management at that level accepts that they need to reintroduce procedures that were part of the culture of health and that in some cases have been allowed to slip or in some cases are just not being duly encouraged. So I don't think we must see this as only a resource-driven process. It's not. A lot of the culture that the DG referred to does not actually cost us money. And I think that the effect of the office is already being felt, not the office now, but the effect of the norms and standards is already being felt in people implementing what they know they should be doing. Some of the standards do require resources, and that is one of the tasks that we've been given is to work on quantifying exactly what that, the impact would be. However, a third very, very important aspect of implementing standards is that the support systems have to function. So if the CEO can't buy a light bulb or can't fix a dripping tap, or if it takes 5 months to get anything repaired or 5 months to get a porter appointed, those kinds of things make it very difficult for facilities to be compliant. And I think without any doubt, those support systems have to be made to work. Likewise, some of it is resource dependent, but certainly not all of it. So, and a third area would then be the support that the DG spoke about in terms of assisting facilities to actually turn around their level of compliance. That is, likewise, is not a very, very expensive exercise. It does require some funds, but it's not very, very expensive. The second thing that the DG asked me to go into was the norms and standards. We have developed over the last 4 years a provisional set of what we call the National Core Standards. These have been developed through a very, very extensive process of consultation and involvement around the country, public sector, but also private sector. We have had private sector people involved from very near the beginning of this process. The standards have been based on our own existing national policies, so they haven't imported policies. They've used what we expect our facilities to comply with. We have tested them several times, including in the extensive audit that the DG described. We have also gone to all provinces. We've conducted a roadshow in every single one of our provinces. We've spoken in many provinces. We've spoken to audiences of all the CEOs and district managers in the province. In some provinces, members of the portfolio committee were actually at these roadshows. And the purpose of this was to familiarize people with the norms and standards and really to challenge them as to being honest with themselves about the reasons why they weren't compliant. And they were extremely positive experiences, and we have once again built back the feedback from these roadshows into the work that we're doing. There are two very new projects that haven't really started yet, but that would take this process to communities. So we have developed some draft materials for communities to inform communities what exactly they should expect from our health facility. And we will, over the next couple of months, be starting to test these in communities and also to test ways that communities could feed back as to whether they are satisfied with the services. One way is surveyed. But in this day and age, this, obviously the use of mobile communications, we need to be able to use that. So that's another thing that we'd be testing. When we come to the point of prescribing, when the future office comes to the point of prescribing norms and standards in law, any process of developing regulations requires a process of transparent and open consultation and consultation with experts. So some of the honourable members spoke about the involvement of statutory bodies, etc. That will obviously have to be part of the process of developing and consulting upon formal regulations. The last point was about these mock inspections and some of the preparatory work that we're doing. I think basically the DG has covered most of that. But what we are also testing is what kind of information has to go to the facilities before they're inspected. How do we communicate the results in a way that actually helps facilities to comply, to understand what they have to do in the future? And also what kind of monitoring system will be needed. So once you've done an inspection, when should you go back? And who will go back? And how much will they do? And what will be the resource implications of that? The second thing that we're also starting to work on is the issue of complaints. Obviously, the provinces, Section 18 of the National Health Act remains in place. So provinces do still have an absolutely critical role through facilities in managing complaints, preferably at the level at which they occur. But there are a number of complaints that are escalated to the Office of the Minister or the DG, and we are using those as a way to test what kinds of reports are required, what kinds of investigations are needed, what kinds of recommendations would be made.
Thanks, Chair President and Honorable Members. There has been an issue that has been raised with the extensive powers of inspectors, and that seems to be concerned, and linked with that is the issue of the right to privacy. In developing this bill, there has been a number of considerations in terms of how these issues can then be addressed. And if I can take members to, if we all have these, the latest bill with us, maybe to Section 84, which then deals with powers of entry and seizure. There has been provisions that have been built that power, the entry into premises and health establishments and the seizure, how that should be conducted. And if you look at that, the entrance must be done in terms or subject to Section 85 and Section 86. Section 86 provides clearly for the protection of right of privacy and how those kind of inspections must then be done. And it is linked specifically to the constitutional right of privacy. It says that any entry upon or search in a premises or health establishment in terms of this act must be conducted with strict regard to decency and good order, including the right to a person's dignity, a right to a person's freedom and security, and the right of a person to privacy. So these are some of the issues that have been considered, say, we do not want this inspector to just have open-ended powers, just to do anything as and when they wish. Again, if you look at it also, this entry and seizure is linked or is limited to premises and health establishment, and it specifically excludes a private dwelling. So, and there are a number of measures that are built in trying to sort of like curb or to sort of like allay the fears that maybe these people might have more powers than what they're supposed to have. And they have to identify themselves so that at least if you have to lay a complaint, then you are able to know this is the person that came to my premises and this is what they done. So obviously you then begin to build all these sorts of safeguard to protect the public against abuse of power by the inspectors. That's the issue. There was another issue that was raised with regard to the 4 years, as to why not specifically 4 years as a cutoff. And some of the issues might be, maybe because when you issue this compliance certificate, there are a number of issues that you will have considered. And maybe in some cases there might be situations that maybe it might warrant that you cannot give a certificate maybe for the full 4 years. Maybe you said, okay, that's it. Circumstances that might warrant a compliance notice to be given for 2 years or for 3 years. But if you specifically state that it has to be 4 years, that means irrespective of whether there are other issues that you might have picked up that might warrant for a lesser period, you will have to go for that period. So I think that that may be one of the rationale for having a cutoff at 4 years and not more than that. The other issue is the issue of the tribunal by the minister. This is in relation to the appeal against the decision of the office or the ombudsman.
Yes.
But what you do not want to is to have a fixed tribunal. Because remember, the complaints vary. If you have a fixed tribunal, you might have a fixed tribunal of how many members? What skills will you require from those? But if you make it an ad hoc tribunal, obviously the minister will look at the nature of the complaint and the nature of the relevant expertise that is required so that he can then be able to then solicit names from those types of skills that are required for him to be able to appoint that appeal to adjudicate specifically on the issue at hand. You do not want to have a situation where you have got a permanent tribunal with a whole list of people in it, but you will want, as and when an appeal comes in, to have the power to solicit the relevant skills and expertise with regard to that issue, and that's the rationale why an issue for an ad hoc tribunal has been mooted. Thanks, DG.
Thanks very much. Our parliamentary legal advisor is here. If he wants to say anything, he will indicate. But there are some questions that I didn't hear the response on. For instance, the authority of the board on the environmental health practitioners that are district municipal. You remember that function was devolved to the municipality. Yeah, what is the authority that you have? And also the logic of appointing only health experts to the board and not take into consideration the users of this health facility. What is the logic behind it? Members, it's open again for the second fight. Okay. There's a hand over there. Let me note you first. You are noted. Honorable Ngube, yes, to us.
Yeah.
You are noted. Divinia. Yeah.
Okay. Over to you.
Thank you, Honorable Panel Chair. Good afternoon, Honorable Member. I think there's a point that was raised by a legal advisor just now to say the inspectors can enter in the premise, but it excludes private building. If that's what you said.
Mm-hmm.
But Section 84, it says it includes private building. It does not exclude that. So I think we should be very careful on that, because what you have just informed us is different and contrary to the Amendment Act itself. And secondly, there was an issue around which I was thinking we're going to talk to say who gives them more power. I think it was raised by Northwest, if I'm not mistaken, to say the health officers, are they given more powers to arrest anybody and everybody? And I don't think that question was also answered. Because I think the challenge would be you giving any individual, and legally speaking, that's not correct. Unless you're talking of citizen arrest, then I'll be comfortable. But now, if you're giving an individual by the name of a health inspector to be arresting people, I think you're growing anarchy in the society that we live in. And we do not want to take that route. There's also an issue that was very central, Chairperson. The issue of one person, a minister, sitting alone and making regulations and coming down to provinces. You know, I know that regional, in terms of the constitution, the regional planning, the province can plan on the issues. But I have a challenge where the minister does not consult other regulatory bodies within the health system that has been established by the Act itself. Are we not recognizing them in this aspect? But I also looked at, I think that would be the last one. I think the DG raised a very important issue here. Because I realized, Chairperson, that the health officers, these are the key functions of, some of the key functions of a person going to be appointed. However, the DG raised an issue of contract management with the CEO to say when you do oversight, I think it also raises a challenge, when you do oversight to hospitals or to any health sector, do you do oversight in contract management to say, CEO, give us contract, let's see how many security guards are there, mortuary, who's working there? And that would need a level of legal qualification in a lot of instances. But not necessarily that would need to, but it will need a certain level for someone to be able to interpret contracts on that and be able to do that. But the challenge would be, it is also good that when honorable members do an oversight, one would be able to say, let's have a fully fledged team that will also have professionals within them so that we can be able to do that. Look at contracts and have challenges on them and be able to explain all those processes. I think that's my submission.
I think I'm partly covered by the legal guru there. But the advisor to the department referred us to Section 94. And that didn't say it.
84.
Okay. I didn't get it. The subpoenas and the enforcement. You talked about the right to get information from other agencies. Does that translate to getting police to arrest? Or what? Thanks.
The next question was, one meeting, Honorable Civilians, we are on the floor, followed by Honorable Makunyane, and who else?
No, no,
thank you.
Chairperson, maybe I did not catch the answer on two of my questions. The one is the inconsequency of norms and standards, that one. And the other one is the qualification of the board members. Now, my other question is in relation to 79D, the election of the appointment of the chairperson and the vice chairperson. Now, that section is saying that the minister appoints the chairperson the vice chairperson. Maybe my understanding is incorrect. Maybe the board must appoint the chairperson or elect the chairperson, and then appointed by the minister. Maybe that is the understanding there. You with me, chairperson?
Yes, I am. I'm all here.
The chairperson and the vice chairperson will be elected by the board and appointed by the minister. Maybe that is the understanding there. If that is the situation, I don't need an explanation to that. And then the CEO, the chairperson, that is 79H, the CEO will also be appointed by the minister Maybe the previous explanation from my side also is in connection with this one. That is two extra questions in this relation. Thank you very much, sir.
Honorable members.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think it would be quite helpful. It would be helpful among the definitions to add the definition of a health establishment as contemplated in the Act, so that it eliminates this for instance, here it says, where it says, as pointed out, that in section 84.1, it says the health officer may enter any premises, including a private dwelling. And then, whereas by another definition, the private dwelling was actually excluded. And then, to clarify once and for all, the inclusion of other facilities that are used as health must be private, including the private. And then the second question was about the public education on the standards as part of the functions of the office, not just for it to be done on an ad hoc basis and so on, but for it to be included as part of the functions, so that it is budgeted for, and that function is clearly defined. Staff is dedicated to that function, and so on. So I was hoping that. Thanks.
Honorable
Judge,
no, sir.
Thank you.
Sorry, I just want to take this quite quickly on the same. Clause 79H, in terms of how the qualification of how they describe a CEO, I am not sure whether I understand it correct that a person who to be appointed must be fit and proper. Fit in, I just want to check in health sense or physical. I'm not that sure. I just wanted to check if I understand whether. Is it a, well, to understand, the understand DJ what I want to check. And because to me, it's very ambiguous. It might mean a person with a healthy, strong body, or body fit is not in terms of qualification. Are you sure, Chen? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Members, and apologies for the omission. With regard to environmental officers, they are not appointed in terms of this amendment.
Oh, okay.
They will remain under the provincial authority and municipalities, except for the port health officers. That was the distinction.
Okay.
Honorable Members, with regard to the composition of the board, I would like to refer honourable members to the actual copy of the amendment. If you go to 79B, it specifies the competencies of the members of the board. It says what expertise of each member must be, but it also refers specifically to the fact that one representative must be from organized labor. It says one representative must be from civil society or the community who are the users of services. So there is already provision for that. With regard to the powers of inspectors, I will defer that to the legal person, including the arrest and other things. But I just wanted to respond to the minister making regulations. That was asked by, I don't know if it's our colleague or an honorable member. I don't know whether it's an honorable member.
No.
Okay.
I wasn't sure if colleagues are allowed to ask us questions, but I'll ask. Yes. Yes. Honorable members, if you go to Section 90 of the Principal Act, it states that the minister will make regulations in consultation with the National Health Council. But it also makes references to other relevant bodies that will be affected by whatever regulations that the minister will be making. So if you refer to the copy of the Act, which, honorable members, is Government Gazette number 26595, it specifies how regulations are made, meaning no regulation will be made without the minister consulting the National Health Council. Now, the National Health Council also includes SALGA members. It also includes SEM, the South African Military Health Services, all the MECs, HODs, and so on. But the minister will also consult when the regulations are published with other statutory bodies. With regard to appointment of the chairperson and vice chairperson, it says the minister shall appoint. I'm not sure whether the member was suggesting that it should be elected members within council. I think that I leave to the committee. That is, yes, but it is specific. It says the minister shall appoint. But if it is the wish of the committee, maybe you can discuss it, but we were recommending that it should be the minister that appoints. With regard to the CEO, the appointment is in after consultation with the board. This one is different, meaning the minister does not appoint. The minister must first consult the board, and it must be the board that recommends to the minister that this is a good CEO or not, and then the minister will appoint, meaning the minister does not do this in unilateral. So this is how it's provided for. The definition of the health establishment are actually in the Principal Act. So I will also refer the honorable members to Gazette 26959. I beg your pardon. Public education, yes, honorable member, we welcome that and would also recommend that perhaps that is an oversight, and it's something that should be carefully and considered. The CEO is a fit and proper person. I'll ask the lawyers to respond, because it's a legal term, they'll respond to that.
Thanks, Chairperson and honorable members. The concept of fit and proper does not relate to the physical fitness of someone who goes to gym on a daily basis and who exercises. This is a person who is fit and proper to perform the functions that relate to the position of the CFO. If a CFO is supposed to be CEO. Okay. If the CEO is the person who is supposed to have certain expertise to perform a particular to perform that function, he needs to have those qualifications. It just indicates that this person must be able to perform the job, the inherent job that he's appointed for. It's not relating to the physical fitness of the person as such. There has been two issues that have been raised by colleagues with regard to the exclusion of the private dwelling, and I can see that we have got two sections. The other one does exclude private dwelling, which is 82, subsection 1. It specifically excludes that. But when you come to 84, it does include that. But the distinction, if you look at that, the other one is with regard to where the warrant is there, which also builds in the safeguards in terms of how a person can then go there. You will have to go to apply to a court or to a judge or to a magistrate so that you have that warrant. That warrant can also impose certain restrictions in terms of how you have to go about that. But your 82 one that that maybe more people might have been concerned with, does specifically exclude the private dwelling. But obviously, if that confuses people, then that doesn't seem that we can then consider. But if you look at your 84, your 84 builds in the requirements and for a warrant. The other issue that the Honourable Member has also raised was the issue of subpoena and whether the police will then be roped in. In the very same section, you will see that there is also the reference to police, that that person can then be accompanied by a police officer. So these are some of the safeguards that have been tried to be put in so that at least those issues are then allayed. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. In relation to Section 84, it was specifically written that it would need to include a private dwelling because at times there is the illegal practice of either nuisances, environmental nuisances, or the illegal practice of health service delivery from a private dwelling. That is not registered as such. So it was written in to make provision for those exceptional circumstances where a private dwelling might be doing what they shouldn't be doing.
Thanks very much, DG and your team. And that question of Honourable de Villiers, do you want to pose it again so that we can check whether we're able to respond to it, debate it as a committee before I release the department?
I will say that.
Well, if you appoint a board, certainly my understanding is the board elects the chairperson and the vice chairperson, and then the minister will appoint after the board decided, because maybe there will be some remuneration coupled with it, and that is my question. I want us as the chairperson to decide on that.
Do you want us to do it now in the presence of the department? Or?
Yeah, I think we are very...
Okay, can committee members...
Democratic.
Respond
to this? If the committee decides, then I don't have a problem.
Yeah, no, thank you, Chair. I think the idea is there should be recommendation by the board before the minister appoints. That is the understanding that I have. Unfortunately, I couldn't follow where you were talking, whether it is strictly to say the minister appoints in the bill. If that is the case, then I would support you that the board recommends to the minister to appoint. Thank you.
Okay.
What do you want?
Oh.
In consultation.
Can you read it to the meeting?
79D1. The minister must appoint the chairperson and vice chairperson of the board from the members contemplated in section 79B1
mm-hmm.
previously. 79B1.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever the chairperson of the board is absent, none. That is not my understanding, it was appointed them as chairperson. My understanding is the minister, not the board.
Oh.
If my understanding is incorrect, just show me to the source.
Yeah, this is where Gary comes in. Can you assist us this?
Thank you, Chairperson. That is the correct interpretation the minister will point. However, that's a policy decision which would then need to be taken to the provinces if any amendments want to be made, but it's the policy decision of this committee which must be taken to the province.
Can I propose?
No, allow him to propose.
Yeah.
Now for discussion.
I'm waiting for the proposal.
Oh.
Yes.
chairperson, my proposal is that the board elected amongst themselves a chairperson and a vice chairperson, appointed then after that by the minister.
Yeah, it's a recommendation. Will it come as the province of Western Cape or of
the
committee?
I can't do it on the side of the Western Cape,
okay,
because I must go back and consult.
All right.
But as member of the committee, I can.
Okay. Honorable Ngo.
Now that he says, we are saying it must come from here, it means we have to debate what he's proposing as a committee.
Yeah.
So you're not affecting it until we debate it as a committee and come up with a solution.
Can we debate it now or later?
Gary?
It must go back to provinces.
Okay.
Yeah. We get proposals
from the provinces.
Yeah, that's the procedure. Okay.
No, thank you, Chair. You know, when we deal with the presentation and not reading the actual text, we miss a lot of things. This page that you referred us to, 79G, there's something else again on 79B, which talks about not less than, no more than 12 members. That is the board. The question that would arise would be what determines the number? Because is it going to be different from one area to the other? I don't know. Why don't we have a specific number? What will tell us if it's 8 or 9, you know?
Honorable members, we had a specific number, a fixed number.
12.
And the portfolio committee had a different view. This is an insertion by the portfolio committee of 7 to 12. So it's another area that the members can discuss.
Honorable Mo?
Chairperson, for you, on 79B, we have A up to H. On A, it says 5 members. That's 5. B, 6. C, 7. D, 8. E, 9. F, 10. G, 11. H, 12. It makes them 12. So if we say between 7, not less than 7, is the board allowed to not to put in others? Because, I mean, it's confusing when you say that when there is a clear specification in terms of which, how many from this category, how many from this category. Thank you.
I think at any point in time, you may not have a full complement of 12 people, but it means that board cannot function because of that. I think that's the principle.
Okay, maybe quorum or something.
Yes, because when we proposed, we had said specific number, and the committee then made this amendment here. Yes.
Meaning that 7 refers to the quorum during the sitting of a meeting.
The minimum, meaning you can't go below 7.
But you have those 12 members. But in a particular meeting, you need to have 7 to continue.
No,
is that the implication?
In essence, it means if you are supposed to have 12, but you organized labor, for instance, has not submitted a name or
okay.
a community, it means the board will still function until such time that the vacancy is filled.
Oh,
so that is a vacancy, not a quorum.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, on that note, I just want to remind the meeting on the procedures that are going to follow out of this meeting, that the issue will be taken to provinces. I'm glad that our colleagues are here today to listen for the first time on the presentation of the bill. The same exercise will be done at provincial level. We will be pleased if
by
the
members.
Department can send their your officials to lead in terms of presentation of these amendments to a provincial level. We will also be there to together with provinces to deal with the same matter. Then the issues will come back to this committee with all the colleagues from provinces again debating all the recommendations or amendments that are made by provinces again before we can go to the final step. So that will be the procedure from now. We'll be informed by the provinces when are they ready.
Yeah, just to technical issue. The second one from here, it's members going to press the province, but not the department. The department may be a backup of the member so that it becomes legal. No, Obani mina bacha is a presenter. Oh, it's me.
I'm just trying to find out the norms and standards that were suggested by the DG. When will they then be presented for us to have a clear understanding as to what those norms and standards are? Will it be within the time where we are dealing with this, or will it be after the bill has been?
No, it will definitely be after, because the committee will have to request them to come and make a presentation on a particular day. That will be after, definitely.
Mm.
Yes, because we are working within a specific time frame here. And we already have a program already that is. Yes.
On that note, is there anything else you can make?
And thank you very much for your presentation that we are making. Up until we meet again.
Thank you. So it has written the public come to us and go to the
How are you?
Order.
Yeah, give another one.